He asked for a commercial that was as revolutionary and astonishing as the product they had created. "I want something that will stop people in their tracks," he said. "I want a thunderclap." The task fell to the Chiat Day Advertising Agency, which had acquired the Apple account when it bought the advertising side of Regis McKenna's business. The person put in charge was a lanky beach bum with a bushy beard, wild hair, goofy grin, and twinkling eyes named Lee Clow, who was the creative director of the agency's office in the Venice Beach section of Los Angeles. Clow was savvy and fun, in a laid-back yet focused way, and he forged a bond with Jobs that would last 3 decades. Clow and 2 of his team, the copywriter Steve Hayden and the art director Brent Thomas, had been toying with a tagline that played off the George Orwell novel, "Why 1984 won't be like 1984. Jobs loved it and asked them to develop it for the Macintosh launch. So they put together a storyboard for a 60-second ad that would look like a scene from a sci-fi movie. It featured a rebellious young woman outrunning the Orwellian thought police and throwing a sledgehammer into a screen showing a mind-controlling speech by Big Brother. The concept captured the zeitgeist of the personal computer revolution. Many young people, especially those in the counterculture, had viewed computers as instruments that could be used by Orwellian governments and giant corporations to sap individuality. But by the end of the 1970s, they were also being seen as potential tools for personal empowerment. The ad cast Macintosh as a warrior for the latter cause, a cool, rebellious, and heroic company that was the only thing standing in the way of the big evil corporation's plan for world domination and total mind control. Jobs liked that. Indeed, the concept for the ad had a special resonance for him. He fancied himself a rebel, and he liked to associate himself with the values of the ragtag band of hackers and pirates he recruited for the Macintosh group. Even though he had left the Apple commune in Oregon to start the Apple Corporation, he still wanted to be viewed as a denizen of the counterculture rather than the corporate culture. But he also realized deep inside that he had increasingly abandoned the hacker spirit. Some might even accuse him of selling out. When Wozniak held true to the homebrew ethic by sharing his design for the Apple I for free, it was Jobs who insisted that they sell the boards instead. He was also the one who, despite Wozniak's reluctance, wanted to turn Apple into a corporation and not freely distribute stock options to the friends who had been in the garage with them. Now he was about to launch the Macintosh, a machine that violated many of the principles of the hacker's code. It was overpriced. It would have no slots, which meant that hobbyists could not plug in their own expansion cards or jack into the motherboard to add their own new functions, and it took special tools just to open the plastic case. It was a closed and controlled system, like something designed by Big Brother rather than by a hacker. So the 1984 ad was a way of reaffirming to himself and to the world his desired self-image. The heroine, with a drawing of a Macintosh emblazoned on her pure white tank top, was a renegade out to foil the establishment. By hiring Ridley Scott, fresh off the success of Blade Runner, as the director, Jobs could attach himself and Apple to the cyberpunk ethos of the time. With the ad, Apple could identify itself with the rebels and hackers who thought differently, and Jobs could reclaim his right to identify with them as well. Scully was initially skeptical when he saw the storyboards, but Jobs insisted that they needed something revolutionary. He was able to get an unprecedented budget of $750,000 just to film the ad, which they planned to premiere during the Super Bowl. Ridley Scott made it in London, using dozens of real skinheads among the enthralled masses listening to Big Brother on the screen. A female discus thrower was chosen to play the heroine. Using a cold industrial setting dominated by metallic gray hues, Scott evoked the dystopian aura of Blade Runner. Just at the moment when Big Brother announces, "We shall prevail," the heroine's hammer smashes the screen and it vaporizes in a flash of light and smoke. When Jobs previewed the ad to the Apple sales force at the meeting in Hawaii, they were thrilled, so he screened it for the board at its December 1983 meeting. When the lights came back on in the boardroom, everyone was mute. Philip Schlein, the CEO of Macy's California, had his head on the table. Mike Markula stared silently. At first it seemed he was overwhelmed by the power of the ad. Then he spoke, "Who wants to move to find a new agency?" Scully recalled, most of them thought it was the worst commercial they had ever seen. Scully himself got cold feet. He asked Chiat Day to sell off the two commercial spots, one 60 seconds, the other 30, that they had purchased. Jobs was beside himself. One evening, Wozniak, who had been floating in and out of Apple for the previous 2 years, wandered into the Macintosh building. Jobs grabbed him and said, "Come over here and look at this." He pulled out a VCR and played the ad. "I was astounded," Woz recalled. "I thought it was the most incredible thing." When Jobs said the board had decided not to run it during the Super Bowl, Wozniak asked what the cost of the time slot was. Jobs told him $800,000. With his usual impulsive goodness, Wozniak immediately offered, "Well, I'll pay half if you will." He ended up not needing to. The agency was able to sell off the 30-second time slot, but in an act of passive defiance, it didn't sell the longer one. "We told them that we couldn't sell the 60-second slot, though in truth we didn't try," recalled Lee Clow. Scully, perhaps to avoid a showdown with either the board or Jobs, decided to let Bill Campbell, the head of marketing, figure out what to do. Campbell, a former football coach, decided to throw the long bomb. "I think we ought to go for it," he told his team. Early in the third quarter of Super Bowl XVIII, the dominant Raiders scored a touchdown against the Redskins, and instead of an instant replay, television screens across the nation went black for an ominous 2 full seconds. Then an eerie black-and-white image of drones marching to spooky music began to fill the screen. More than 96 million people watched an ad that was unlike any they'd seen before. At its end, as the drones watched in horror the vaporizing of Big Brother, an announcer calmly intoned, "On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984. It was a sensation. That evening, all three networks and 50 local stations aired news stories about the ad, giving it a viral life unprecedented in the pre-YouTube era. It would eventually be selected by both TV Guide and Advertising Age as the greatest commercial of all time. Publicity Blast. Over the years, Steve Jobs would become the grand master of product launches. In the case of the Macintosh, the astonishing Ridley Scott ad was just one of the ingredients. Another part of the recipe was media coverage. Jobs found ways to ignite blasts of publicity that were so powerful the frenzy would feed on itself like a chain reaction. It was a phenomenon that he would be able to replicate whenever there was a big product launch, from the Macintosh in 1984 to the iPad in 2010. Like a conjurer, he could pull the trick off over and over again, even after journalists had seen it happen a dozen times and knew how it was done. Some of the moves he had learned from Regis McKenna, who was a pro at cultivating and stroking prideful reporters. But Jobs had his own intuitive sense of how to stoke the excitement, manipulate the competitive instincts of journalists, and trade exclusive access for lavish treatment. In December 1983, he took his elfin engineering wizards, Andy Hertzfeld and Burl Smith, to New York to visit Newsweek to pitch a story on the kids who created the Mac. After giving a demo of the Macintosh, they were taken upstairs to meet Catherine Graham, the legendary proprietor who had an insatiable interest in whatever was new. Afterward, the magazine sent its technology columnist and a photographer to spend time in Palo Alto with Hertzfeld and Smith. The result was a flattering and smart 4-page profile of the two of them, with pictures that made them look like cherubim of a new age. The article quoted Smith saying what he wanted to do next. "I want to build the computer of the 90s, only I want to do it tomorrow." The article also described the mix of volatility and charisma displayed by his boss. Jobs sometimes defends his ideas with highly vocal displays of temper that aren't always bluster. Rumor has it that he has threatened to fire employees for insisting that his computers should have cursor keys, a feature that Jobs considers obsolete. But when he is on his best behavior, Jobs is a curious blend of charm and impatience, oscillating between shrewd reserve and his favorite expression of enthusiasm, insanely great. The technology writer, Stephen Levy, who was then working for Rolling Stone, came to interview Jobs, who urged him to convince the magazine's publisher to put the Macintosh team on the cover of the magazine. The chances of Jan Wenner agreeing to displace Sting in favor of a bunch of computer nerds were approximately one in a Googleplex, Levy thought correctly. Jobs took Levy to a pizza joint and pressed the case. Rolling Stone was on the ropes, running crummy articles, looking desperately for new topics and new audiences. The Mac could be its salvation. Levy pushed back. Rolling Stone was actually good, he said, and he asked Jobs if he had read it recently. Jobs said that he had, an article about MTV that was a piece of shit. Levy replied that he had written that article. Jobs, to his credit, didn't back away from the assessment. Instead, he turned philosophical as he talked about the Macintosh. "We are constantly benefiting from advances that went before us and taking things that people before us developed," he said. "It's a wonderful, ecstatic feeling to create something that puts it back in the pool of human experience and knowledge." Levy's story didn't make it to the cover, but in the future, every major product launch that Jobs was involved in, at Next, at Pixar, and years later when he returned to Apple, would end up on the cover of either Time, Newsweek, or Business Week. January 24, 1984. On the morning that he and his teammates completed the software for the Macintosh, Andy Hertzfeld had gone home exhausted and expected to stay in bed for at least a day. But that afternoon, after only 6 hours of sleep, he drove back to the office. He wanted to check in to see if there had been any problems, and most of his colleagues had done the same. They were lounging around, dazed but excited, when Jobs walked in. "Hey, pick yourselves up off the floor. We're not done yet," he announced. "We need a demo for the intro." His plan was to dramatically unveil the Macintosh in front of a large audience and have it show off some of its features to the inspirational theme from Chariots of Fire. "It needs to be done by the weekend to be ready for the rehearsals," he added. They all groaned, Hertzfeld recalled, "but as we talked, we realized that it would be fun to cook up something impressive." The launch event was scheduled for the Apple annual stockholders meeting on January 24th, 8 days away, at the Flint Auditorium of De Anza Community College. The television ad and the frenzy of press preview stories were the first two components in what would become the Steve Jobs playbook for making the introduction of a new product seem like an epical moment in world history. The third component was the public unveiling of the product itself, amid fanfare and flourishes, in front of an audience of adoring faithful mixed with journalists who were primed to be swept up in the excitement. Hertzfeld pulled off the remarkable feat of writing a music player in 2 days so that the computer could play the Chariots of Fire theme. But when Jobs heard it, he judged it lousy, so they decided to use a recording instead. At the same time, Jobs was thrilled with a speech generator that turned text into spoken words with a charming electronic accent, and he decided to make it part of the demo. "I want the Macintosh to be the first computer to introduce itself," he insisted. At the rehearsal the night before the launch, nothing was working well. Jobs hated the way the animation scrolled across the Macintosh screen, and he kept ordering tweaks. He also was dissatisfied with the stage lighting, and he directed Scully to move from seat to seat to give his opinion as various adjustments were made. Scully had never thought much about variations of stage lighting and gave the type of tentative answers a patient might give an eye doctor when asked which lens made the letters clearer. The rehearsals and changes went on for 5 hours, well into the night. He was driving people insane, getting mad at the stagehands for every glitch in the presentation, Scully recalled. "I thought there was no way we were going to get it done for the show the next morning." Most of all, Jobs fretted about his presentation. Scully fancied himself a good writer, so he suggested changes in Jobs' script. Jobs recalled being slightly annoyed, but their relationship was still in the phase when he was lathering on flattery and stroking Scully's ego. "I think of you just like Woz and Markula," he told Scully. "You're like one of the founders of the company. They founded the company, but you and I are founding the future." Scully lapped it up. The next morning, the 2,600-seat auditorium was mobbed. Jobs arrived in a double-breasted blue blazer, a starched white shirt, and a pale green bow tie. "This is the most important moment in my entire life," he told Scully as they waited backstage for the program to begin. "I'm really nervous. You're probably the only person who knows how I feel about this." Scully grasped his hand, held it for a moment, and whispered, "Good luck." As chairman of the company, Jobs went on stage first to start the shareholders' meeting. He did so with his own form of an invocation. "I'd like to open the meeting," he said, "with a 20-year-old poem by Dylan." That's Bob Dylan. He broke into a little smile, then looked down to read from the second verse of "The Times They Are a-Changin'." His voice was high-pitched as he raced through the 10 lines, ending with, "For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changin'." That song was the anthem that kept the multimillionaire board chairman in touch with his counterculture self-image. He had a bootleg copy of his favorite version, which was from the live concert Dylan performed with Joan Baez on Halloween 1964 at Lincoln Center's Philharmonic Hall. Scully came on stage to report on the company's earnings, and the audience started to become restless as he droned on. Finally, he ended with a personal note. "The most important thing that has happened to me in the last 9 months at Apple has been a chance to develop a friendship with Steve Jobs," he said. "For me, the rapport we have developed means an awful lot." The lights dimmed as Jobs reappeared on stage and launched into a dramatic version of the battle cry he had delivered at the Hawaii sales conference. "It is 1958, he began. "IBM passes up a chance to buy a young fledgling company that has invented a new technology called xerography. 2 years later, Xerox was born, and IBM has been kicking themselves ever since." The crowd laughed. Hertzfeld had heard versions of the speech both in Hawaii and elsewhere, but he was struck by how this time it was pulsing with more passion. After recounting other IBM missteps, Jobs picked up the pace and the emotion as he built toward the present. "It is now 1984, It appears that IBM wants it all. Apple is perceived to be the only hope to offer IBM a run for its money. Dealers, after initially welcoming IBM with open arms, now fear an IBM-dominated and controlled future, and are turning back to Apple as the only force who can ensure their future freedom. IBM wants it all, and is aiming its guns at its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right? As he built to the climax, the audience went from murmuring to applauding to a frenzy of cheering and chanting. But before they could answer the Orwell question, the auditorium went black and the 1984 commercial appeared on the screen. When it was over, the entire audience was on its feet, cheering. With a flair for the dramatic, Jobs walked across the dark stage to a small table with a cloth bag on it. "Now I'd like to show you Macintosh in person," he said. He took out the computer, keyboard, and mouse, hooked them together deftly, then pulled one of the new 3.5-inch floppies from his shirt pocket. The theme from Chariots of Fire began to play. Jobs held his breath for a moment, because the demo had not worked well the night before, but this time it ran flawlessly. The word Macintosh scrolled horizontally on screen, then underneath it the words "Insanely Great" appeared in script, as if being slowly written by hand. Not used to such beautiful graphic displays, the audience quieted for a moment. A few gasps could be heard, and then, in rapid succession, came a series of screenshots, Bill Atkinson's quick draw graphics package, followed by displays of different fonts, documents, charts, drawings, a chess game, a spreadsheet, and a rendering of Steve Jobs with a thought bubble containing a Macintosh. When it was over, Jobs smiled and offered a treat. "We've done a lot of talking about Macintosh recently," he said, "but today, for the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself." With that, he strolled back over to the computer, pressed the button on the mouse, and in a vibrato but endearing electronic deep voice, Macintosh became the first computer to introduce itself. "Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag," it began. The only thing it didn't seem to know how to do was to wait for the wild cheering and shrieks that erupted. Instead of basking for a moment, it barreled ahead. "Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't lift." Once again, the roar almost drowned out its final lines. "Obviously, I can talk, but right now I'd like to sit back and listen. So it is with considerable pride that I introduce a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs." Pandemonium erupted, with people in the crowd jumping up and down and pumping their fists in a frenzy. Jobs nodded slowly, a tight-lipped but broad smile on his face, then looked down and started to choke up. The ovation continued for 5 minutes. After the Macintosh team returned to Banley 3 that afternoon, a truck pulled into the parking lot and Jobs had them all gather next to it. Inside were 100 new Macintosh computers, each personalized with a plaque. Steve presented them one at a time to each team member with a handshake and a smile as the rest of us stood around cheering, Hertzfeld recalled. It had been a grueling ride, and many egos had been bruised by Jobs's obnoxious and rough management style. But neither Raskin, nor Wozniak, nor Scully, nor anyone else at the company could have pulled off the creation of the Macintosh. Nor would it likely have emerged from focus groups and committees. On the day he unveiled the Macintosh, a reporter from Popular Science asked Jobs what type of market research he had done. Jobs responded by scoffing. Did Alexander Graham Bell do any market research before he invented the telephone? Chapter 16. Gates and Jobs. When Orbits Intersect. The Macintosh Partnership. In astronomy, a binary system occurs when the orbits of two stars are linked because of their gravitational interaction. There have been analogous situations in history when an era is shaped by the relationship and rivalry of two orbiting superstars. Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr in 20th century physics, for example, or Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton in early American governance. For the first 30 years of the personal computer age, beginning in the late 1970s, the defining binary star system was composed of two high-energy college dropouts, both born in 1955. Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, despite their similar ambitions at the confluence of technology and business, had very different personalities and backgrounds. Gates's father was a prominent Seattle lawyer, his mother a civic leader on a variety of prestigious boards. He became a tech geek at the area's finest private school, Lakeside High, but he was never a rebel, hippie, spiritual seeker, or member of the counterculture. Instead of a blue box to rip off the phone company, Gates created for his school a program for scheduling classes, which helped him get into ones with the right girls, and a car counting program for local traffic engineers. He went to Harvard, and when he decided to drop out, it was not to find enlightenment with an Indian guru, but to start a computer software company. Gates was good at computer coding, unlike Jobs, and his mind was more practical, disciplined, and abundant in analytic processing power. Jobs was more intuitive and romantic, and had a greater instinct for making technology usable, design delightful, and interfaces friendly. He had a passion for perfection, which made him fiercely demanding, and he managed by charisma and scattershot intensity. Gates was more methodical. He held tightly scheduled product review meetings where he would cut to the heart of issues with lapidary skill. Both could be rude, but with Gates, who early in his career seemed to have a typical geek's flirtation with the fringes of the Asperger's scale, the cutting behavior tended to be less personal, based more on intellectual incisiveness than emotional callousness. Jobs would stare at people with a burning, wounding intensity. Gates sometimes had trouble making eye contact, but he was fundamentally humane. Each one thought he was smarter than the other one, but Steve generally treated Bill as someone who was slightly inferior, especially in matters of taste and style, said Andy Hertzfeld. Bill looked down on Steve because he couldn't actually program. From the beginning of their relationship, Gates was fascinated by Jobs and slightly envious of his mesmerizing effect on people. But he also found him fundamentally odd and weirdly flawed as a human being, and he was put off by Jobs's rudeness and his tendency to be either in the mode of saying you were shit or trying to seduce you. For his part, Jobs found Gates unnervingly narrow. He'd be a broader guy if he had dropped acid once or gone off to an ashram when he was younger, Jobs once declared. Their differences in personality and character would lead them to opposite sides of what would become the fundamental divide in the digital age. Jobs was a perfectionist who craved control and indulged in the uncompromising temperament of an artist. He and Apple became the exemplars of a digital strategy that tightly integrated hardware, software, and content into a seamless package. Gates was a smart, calculating, and pragmatic analyst of business and technology. He was open to licensing Microsoft's operating system and software to a variety of manufacturers. After 30 years, Gates would develop a grudging respect for Jobs. He really never knew much about technology, but he had an amazing instinct for what works, he said. But Jobs never reciprocated by fully appreciating Gates' real strengths. Bill is basically unimaginative and has never invented anything, which is why I think he's more comfortable now in philanthropy than technology, Jobs said unfairly. He just shamelessly ripped off other people's ideas. When the Macintosh was first being developed, Jobs went up to visit Gates at his office near Seattle. Microsoft had written some applications for the Apple II, including a spreadsheet program called MultiPlan, and Jobs wanted to excite Gates and company about doing even more for the forthcoming Macintosh. Sitting in Gates' conference room, Jobs spun an enticing vision of a computer for the masses with a friendly interface, which would be churned out by the millions in an automated California factory. His description of the dream factory sucking in the California silicon components and turning out finished Macintoshes caused the Microsoft team to codename the project SAND. They even reverse-engineered it into an acronym for Steve's Amazing New Device. Gates had launched Microsoft by writing a version of BASIC, a programming language for the Altair. Jobs wanted Microsoft to write a version of BASIC for the Macintosh, because Wozniak, despite much prodding by Jobs, had never enhanced his version of the Apple II's BASIC to handle floating-point numbers. In addition, Jobs wanted Microsoft to write application software, such as word processing and spreadsheet programs for the Macintosh. At the time, Jobs was a king and Gates still a courtier. In 1982, Apple's annual sales were $1 billion, while Microsoft's were a mere $32 million. Gates signed on to do graphical versions of a new spreadsheet called Excel, a word processing program called Word, and BASIC. Gates frequently went to Cupertino for demonstrations of the Macintosh operating system, and he was not very impressed. I remember the first time we went down, Steve had this app where it was just things bouncing around on the screen, he said. That was the only app that ran. Gates was also put off by Jobs' attitude. It was kind of a weird seduction visit, where Steve was saying, "We don't really need you, and we're doing this great thing, and it's under the cover." He's in his Steve Jobs sales mode, but kind of the sales mode that also says, "I don't need you, but I might let you be involved." The Macintosh pirates found Gates hard to take. You could tell that Bill Gates was not a very good listener. He couldn't bear to have anyone explain how something worked to him. He had to leap ahead instead and guess about how he thought it would work, Hertzfeldt recalled. They showed him how the Macintosh's cursor moves smoothly across the screen without flickering. "What kind of hardware do you use to draw the cursor?" Gates asked. Hertzfeldt, who took great pride that they could achieve their functionality solely using software, replied, "We don't have any special hardware for it." Gates insisted that it was necessary to have special hardware to move the cursor that way. "So what do you say to somebody like that?" Bruce Horn, one of the Macintosh engineers, later said. It made it clear to me that Gates was not the kind of person that would understand or appreciate the elegance of a Macintosh. Despite their mutual wariness, both teams were excited by the prospect that Microsoft would create graphical software for the Macintosh that would take personal computing into a new realm, and they went to dinner at a fancy restaurant to celebrate. Microsoft soon dedicated a large team to the task. "We had more people working on the Mac than he did," Gates said. He had about 14 or 15 people. We had like 20 people. We really bet our life on it. And even though Jobs thought that they didn't exhibit much taste, the Microsoft programmers were persistent. They came out with applications that were terrible, Jobs recalled. But they kept at it, and they made them better. Eventually, Jobs became so enamored of Excel that he made a secret bargain with Gates. If Microsoft would make Excel exclusively for the Macintosh for 2 years and not make a version for IBM PCs, then Jobs would shut down his team working on a version of BASIC for the Macintosh and instead indefinitely license Microsoft's BASIC. Gates smartly took the deal, which infuriated the Apple team, whose project got canceled and gave Microsoft a lever in future negotiations. For the time being, Gates and Jobs forged a bond. That summer, they went to a conference hosted by the industry analyst Ben Rosen at a Playboy Club retreat in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, where nobody knew about the graphical interfaces that Apple was developing. Everybody was acting like the IBM PC was everything, which was nice, but Steve and I were kind of smiling that, hey, we've got something, Gates recalled. And he's kind of leaking, but nobody actually caught on. Gates became a regular at Apple retreats. I went to every luau, said Gates. I was part of the crew. Gates enjoyed his frequent visits to Cupertino, where he got to watch Jobs interact erratically with his employees and display his obsessions. Steve was in his ultimate Pied Piper mode, proclaiming how the Mac will change the world and overworking people like mad, with incredible tensions and complex personal relationships. Sometimes Jobs would begin on a high, then lapse into sharing his fears with Gates. We'd go down Friday night, have dinner, and Steve would just be promoting that everything is great. Then the second day, without fail, he'd be kind of, oh shit, is this thing going to sell? Oh God, I have to raise the price. I'm sorry I did that to you, and my team is a bunch of idiots. Gates saw Jobs's reality distortion field at play when the Xerox Star was launched. At a joint team dinner one Friday night, Jobs asked Gates how many stars had been sold thus far. Gates said 600. The next day, in front of Gates and the whole team, Jobs said that 300 stars had been sold, forgetting that Gates had just told everyone it was actually 600. So his whole team starts looking at me like, are you going to tell him that he's full of shit? Gates recalled. And in that case, I didn't take the bait. On another occasion, Jobs and his team were visiting Microsoft and having dinner at the Seattle Tennis Club. Jobs launched into a sermon about how the Macintosh and its software would be so easy to use that there would be no manuals. It was like anybody who ever thought that there would be a manual for any Mac application was the greatest idiot, said Gates. And we were like, does he really mean it? Should we not tell him that we have people who are actually working on manuals? After a while, the relationship became bumpier. The original plan was to have some of the Microsoft applications, such as Excel, Chart, and File, carry the Apple logo and come bundled with the purchase of a Macintosh. We were going to get $10 per app per machine, said Gates. But this arrangement upset competing software makers. In addition, it seemed that some of Microsoft's programs might be late. So Jobs invoked a provision in his deal with Microsoft and decided not to bundle its software. Microsoft would have to scramble to distribute its software as products sold directly to consumers. Gates went along without much complaint. He was already getting used to the fact that, as he put it, Jobs could play fast and loose, and he suspected that the unbundling would actually help Microsoft. We could make more money selling our software separately, Gates said. It works better that way if you're willing to think you're going to have a reasonable market share. Microsoft ended up making its software for various other platforms, and it began to give priority to the IBM PC version of Microsoft Word, rather than the Macintosh version. In the end, Jobs' decision to back out of the bundling deal hurt Apple more than it did Microsoft. When Excel for the Macintosh was released, Jobs and Gates unveiled it together at a press dinner at New York's Tavern on the Green. Asked if Microsoft would make a version of it for IBM PCs, Gates did not reveal the bargain he had made with Jobs, but merely answered that, in time, that might happen. Jobs took the microphone. "I'm sure in time we'll all be dead," he joked. The Battle of the GUI. At that time, Microsoft was producing an operating system known as DOS, which it licensed to IBM and compatible computers. It was based on an old-fashioned command-line interface that confronted users with surly little prompts such as C:\right angle. As Jobs and his team began to work closely with Microsoft, they grew worried that it would copy Macintosh's graphical user interface. Andy Hertzfeld noticed that his contact at Microsoft was asking detailed questions about how the Macintosh operating system worked. "I told Steve that I suspected that Microsoft was going to clone the Mac," he recalled. They were right to worry. Gates believed that graphical interfaces were the future, and that Microsoft had just as much right as Apple did to copy what had been developed at Xerox PARC. As he freely admitted later, "We sort of say, hey, we believe in graphics interfaces. We saw the Xerox Alto, too." In their original deal, Jobs had convinced Gates to agree that Microsoft would not create graphical software for anyone other than Apple until a year after the Macintosh shipped in January 1983. Unfortunately for Apple, it did not provide for the possibility that the Macintosh launch would be delayed for a year. So Gates was within his rights when, in November 1983, he revealed that Microsoft planned to develop a new operating system for IBM PCs featuring a graphical interface with windows, icons, and a mouse for point-and-click navigation. It would be called Windows. Gates hosted a Jobs-like product announcement, the most lavish thus far in Microsoft's history, at the Helmsley Palace Hotel in New York. Jobs was furious. He knew there was little he could do about it. Microsoft's deal with Apple not to do competing graphical operating software was running out, but he lashed out nonetheless. "Get Gates down here immediately," he ordered Mike Boych, who was Apple's evangelist to other software companies. Gates arrived, alone and willing to discuss things with Jobs. "He called me down to get pissed off at me," Gates recalled. "I went down to Cupertino, like a command performance. I told him, 'We're doing Windows.' I said to him, 'We're betting our company on graphical interfaces.'" They met in Jobs's conference room, where Gates found himself surrounded by 10 Apple employees who were eager to watch their boss assail him. Jobs didn't disappoint his troops. "You're ripping us off," he shouted. "I trusted you, and now you're stealing from us." Hertzfeld recalled that Gates just sat there coolly, looking Steve in the eye before hurling back in his squeaky voice what became a classic zinger. "Well, Steve, I think there's more than one way of looking at it. I think it's more like we both had this rich neighbor named Xerox, and I broke into his house to steal the TV set and found out that you had already stolen it." Gates's two-day visit provoked the full range of Jobs's emotional responses and manipulation techniques. It also made clear that the Apple-Microsoft symbiosis had become a scorpion dance, with both sides circling warily, knowing that a sting by either could cause problems for both. After the confrontation in the conference room, Gates quietly gave Jobs a private demo of what was being planned for Windows. "Steve didn't know what to say," Gates recalled. "He could either say, 'Oh, this is a violation of something,' but he didn't. He chose to say, 'Oh, it's actually really a piece of shit.'" Gates was thrilled. because it gave him a chance to calm Jobs down for a moment. I said, "Yes, it's a nice little piece of shit." So Jobs went through a gamut of other emotions. "During the course of this meeting, he's just ruder than shit," Gates said. "And then there's a part where he's almost crying, like, 'Oh, just give me a chance to get this thing off.'" Gates responded by becoming very calm. "I'm good at when people are emotional. I'm kind of less emotional." As he often did when he wanted to have a serious conversation, Jobs suggested they go on a long walk. They trekked the streets of Cupertino, back and forth to De Anza College, stopping at a diner and then walking some more. "We had to take a walk, which is not one of my management techniques," Gates said. That was when he began saying things like, "Okay, okay, but don't make it too much like what we're doing." As it turned out, Microsoft wasn't able to get Windows 1.0 ready for shipping until the fall of 1985. Even then, it was a shoddy product. It lacked the elegance of the Macintosh interface, and it had tiled windows rather than the magical clipping of overlapping windows that Bill Atkinson had devised. Reviewers ridiculed it, and consumers spurned it. Nevertheless, as is often the case with Microsoft products, persistence eventually made Windows better and then dominant. Jobs never got over his anger. "They just ripped us off completely, because Gates has no shame," Jobs told me almost 30 years later. Upon hearing this, Gates responded, "If he believes that, he really has entered into one of his own reality distortion fields." In a legal sense, Gates was right, as courts over the years have subsequently ruled. And on a practical level, he had a strong case as well. Even though Apple made a deal for the right to use what it saw at Xerox PARC, it was inevitable that other companies would develop similar graphical interfaces. As Apple found out, the look and feel of a computer interface design is a hard thing to protect. And yet Jobs's dismay was understandable. Apple had been more innovative, imaginative, elegant in execution, and brilliant in design. But even though Microsoft created a crudely copied series of products, it would end up winning the war of operating systems. This exposed an aesthetic flaw in how the universe worked. The best and most innovative products don't always win. A decade later, this truism cost Jobs to let loose a rant that was somewhat arrogant and over the top, but also had a whiff of truth to it. "The only problem with Microsoft is they just have no taste. They have absolutely no taste," he said. "I don't mean that in a small way. I mean that in a big way, in the sense that they don't think of original ideas and they don't bring much culture into their product." Chapter 17. Icarus. What goes up? Flying high. The launch of the Macintosh in January 1984 propelled Jobs into an even higher orbit of celebrity, as was evident during a trip to Manhattan he took at the time. He went to a party that Yoko Ono threw for her son, Sean Lennon, and gave the 9-year-old a Macintosh. The boy loved it. The artists Andy Warhol and Keith Haring were there, and they were so enthralled by what they could create with the machine that the contemporary art world almost took an ominous turn. "I drew a circle," Warhol exclaimed proudly after using QuickDraw. Warhol insisted that Jobs take a computer to Mick Jagger. When Jobs arrived at the rock star's townhouse, Jagger seemed baffled. He didn't quite know who Jobs was. Later, Jobs told his team, "I think he was on drugs. Either that or he's brain damaged." Jagger's daughter Jade, however, took to the computer immediately and started drawing with Mac Paint, so Jobs gave it to her instead. He bought the top-floor duplex apartment that he'd shown Scully in the San Remo on Manhattan's Central Park West and hired James Freed of I.M. Pei's firm to renovate it, but he never moved in. He would later sell it to Bono for $15 million. He also bought an old Spanish colonial-style 14-bedroom mansion in Woodside, in the hills above Palo Alto, that had been built by a copper baron, which he moved into but never got around to furnishing. At Apple, his status revived. Instead of seeking ways to curtail Jobs's authority, Scully gave him more. The Lisa and Macintosh divisions were folded together, with Jobs in charge. He was flying high, but this did not serve to make him more mellow. Indeed, there was a memorable display of his brutal honesty when he stood in front of the combined Lisa and Macintosh teams to describe how they would be merged. His Macintosh group leaders would get all of the top positions, he said, and a quarter of the Lisa staff would be laid off. "You guys failed," he said, looking directly at those who had worked on the Lisa. "You're a B team. B players. Too many people here are B or C players. So today, we are releasing some of you to have the opportunity to work at our sister companies here in the Valley." Bill Atkinson, who had worked on both teams, thought it was not only callous, but unfair. "These people had worked really hard and were brilliant engineers," he said. But Jobs had latched on to what he believed was a key management lesson from his Macintosh experience. "You have to be ruthless if you want to build a team of A players. It's too easy as a team grows to put up with a few B players, and they then attract a few more B players, and soon you will even have some C players," he recalled. "The Macintosh experience taught me that A players like to work only with other A players, which means you can't indulge B players." For the time being, Jobs and Scully were able to convince themselves that their friendship was still strong. They professed their fondness so effusively and often that they sounded like high school sweethearts at a Hallmark card display. The first anniversary of Scully's arrival came in May 1984, and to celebrate, Jobs lured him to a dinner party at Le Mouton Noir, an elegant restaurant in the hills southwest of Cupertino. To Scully's surprise, Jobs had gathered the Apple board, its top managers, and even some East Coast investors. As they all congratulated him during cocktails, Scully recalled, "A beaming Steve stood in the background, nodding his head up and down and wearing a Cheshire Cat smile on his face." Jobs began the dinner with a fulsome toast. "The happiest 2 days for me were when Macintosh shipped and when John Scully agreed to join Apple," he said. "This has been the greatest year I've ever had in my whole life because I've learned so much from John." He then presented Scully with a montage of memorabilia from the year. In response, Scully effused about the joys of being Jobs's partner for the past year, and he concluded with a line that, for different reasons, everyone at the table found memorable. "Apple has one leader," he said, "Steve and me." He looked across the room, caught Jobs's eye, and watched him smile. "It was as if we were communicating with each other," Scully recalled. But he also noticed that Arthur Rock and some of the others were looking quizzical, perhaps even skeptical. They were worried that Jobs was completely rolling him. They had hired Scully to control Jobs, and now it was clear that Jobs was the one in control. Scully was so eager for Steve's approval that he was unable to stand up to him, Rock recalled. Keeping Jobs happy and deferring to his expertise may have seemed like a smart strategy to Scully, but he failed to realize that it was not in Jobs' nature to share control. Deference did not come naturally to him. He began to become more vocal about how he thought the company should be run. At the 1984 business strategy meeting, for example, he pushed to make the company's centralized sales and marketing staffs bid on the right to provide their services to the various product divisions. This would have meant, for example, that the Macintosh group could decide not to use Apple's marketing team and instead create one of its own. No one else was in favor, but Jobs kept trying to ram it through. People were looking to me to take control, to get him to sit down and shut up, but I didn't, Scully recalled. As the meeting broke up, he heard someone whisper, "Why doesn't Scully shut him up?" When Jobs decided to build a state-of-the-art factory in Fremont to manufacture the Macintosh, his aesthetic passions and controlling nature kicked into high gear. He wanted the machinery to be painted in bright hues, like the Apple logo, but he spent so much time going over paint chips that Apple's manufacturing director, Matt Carter, finally just installed them in their usual beige and gray. When Jobs took a tour, he ordered that the machines be repainted in the bright colors he wanted. Carter objected. This was precision equipment, and repainting the machines could cause problems. He turned out to be right. One of the most expensive machines, which got painted bright blue, ended up not working properly and was dubbed Steve's Folly. Finally, Carter quit. It took so much energy to fight him, and it was usually over something so pointless that finally I had enough, he recalled. Jobs tapped as a replacement Debbie Coleman, the spunky but good-natured Macintosh financial officer who had once won the team's annual award for the person who best stood up to Jobs. But she knew how to cater to his whims when necessary. When Apple's art director, Clement Mock, informed her that Jobs wanted the walls to be pure white, she protested. "You can't paint a factory pure white. There's going to be dust and stuff all over," Mock replied. "There's no white that's too white for Steve." She ended up going along. With its pure white walls and its bright blue, yellow, and red machines, the factory floor looked like an Alexander Calder showcase, said Coleman. When asked about his obsessive concern over the look of the factory, Jobs said it was a way to ensure a passion for perfection. "I'd go out to the factory, and I'd put on a white glove to check for dust. I'd find it everywhere, on machines, on the tops of the racks, on the floor, and I'd ask Debbie to get it cleaned. I told her I thought we should be able to eat off the floor of the factory." Well, this drove Debbie up the wall. She didn't understand why, and I couldn't articulate it back then. See, I'd been very influenced by what I'd seen in Japan. Part of what I greatly admired there, and part of what we were lacking in our factory, was a sense of teamwork and discipline. If we didn't have the discipline to keep that place spotless, then we weren't going to have the discipline to keep all these machines running. One Sunday morning, Jobs brought his father to see the factory. Paul Jobs had always been fastidious about making sure that his craftsmanship was exacting and his tools in order, and his son was proud to show that he could do the same. Coleman came along to give the tour. Steve was like beaming, she recalled. He was so proud to show his father this creation. Jobs explained how everything worked, and his father seemed truly admiring. He kept looking at his father, who touched everything and loved how clean and perfect everything looked. Things were not quite as sweet when Danielle Mitterrand toured the factory. The Cuba-admiring wife of France's socialist president, François Mitterrand, asked a lot of questions through her translator about the working conditions, while Jobs, who had grabbed Alain Rossman to serve as his translator, kept trying to explain the advanced robotics and technology. After Jobs talked about the just-in-time production schedules, she asked about overtime pay. He was annoyed, so he described how automation helped him keep down labor costs, a subject he knew would not delight her. "Is it hard work?" she asked. "How much vacation time do they get?" Jobs couldn't contain himself. "If she's so interested in their welfare," he said to her translator, "tell her she can come work here any time." The translator turned pale and said nothing. After a moment, Rossman stepped in to say, in French, "Monsieur Jobs says he thanks you for your visit and your interest in the factory." Neither Jobs nor Madame Mitterrand knew what happened, Rossman recalled, but her translator looked very relieved. Afterward, as he sped his Mercedes down the freeway toward Cupertino, Jobs fumed to Rossman about Madame Mitterrand's attitude. At one point, he was going just over 100 miles per hour when a policeman stopped him and began writing a ticket. After a few minutes, as the officer scribbled away, Jobs honked. "Excuse me," the policeman said. Jobs replied, "I'm in a hurry." Amazingly, the officer didn't get mad. He simply finished writing.